I want to thank you for getting me out of the home tonight. You know, from the neck up, I'm about 12 years old. But the rest of my body says different. I'm sure that there are some of you here who feel the same way that I do, that going to bed at night begins with a removal of parts. The other night going to bed, I looked over and there was more of me on the dresser than in the bed. Where is the person from Cork, Ireland? No, not here. Where? Hi. My eyes aren't too good tonight. I just had cataract surgery the last couple of weeks on both eyes, and I don't have a new prescription yet. So, well, the good part is I can't see all the ugly faces clearly. But the bad part is everybody's blurred. But anyhow, there was a fellow in a pub in Dublin, and he was drinking a pint, and a fellow came in and stood at the opposite end of the bar, and after a few minutes, another one came, stood beside him. And being of a friendly nature, one of them said to the other, "And where are you from?" And the other one said, "Cork." "Ah," he said, "are you now? I am too." "And where in Cork?" He said, "I'm from the town of Mallow." "Ah," he said, "you can't be serious. That's my hometown." "And where did you live?" he said, "on a street called O'Donnell." I said, "Good God!" He said, "I was born and raised on that street." "What was your mother's first name?" he said, "Mary." Said, "Oh my God," he turned white. "So was mine." And he said, "Your dad?" He said, "James." And the guy was just silent. He was stunned. And the first man in the bar said, "What in the name of heavens is that all about?" And the barkeep said, "I said, that's the O'Shaughnessy twins. They're drunk again." "And where are you from?" But there was a young man that went into a bar, and he ordered a dozen double shots of the most expensive cognac that money could buy. And they were lined up on the bar, and he began firing them down as quickly as he could swallow. And the bartender said, "Whoa," he said, "that's good stuff." He said, "Slow down and enjoy it." "Ah," he said, "if you had what I have, you'd drink fast too." He said, "In the name of God, what do you have?" He said, 50 cents. I'm an alcoholic. My name happens to be Father Martin. I mentioned the one for, I remember years ago in an AA meeting when somebody did that for the first time. Usually you say, "My name's so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic." And this fellow said, "I'm an alcoholic, my name is so-and-so." And I'm wondering, why the gimmicky, you know, way of doing things? And a man a while later explained it to me, and that's why I will tell you, that's why I do it. My alcoholism is the center of my life. Everything revolves around it. Because if my sobriety does not come first, there will be nothing to come second. My name is nothing more than a verbal identification tag. That's all. Legally, you can change your name. I can never change my alcoholism. That'll be with me till I die. I'm always asked by people, I speak for a living. And they say, "Father, do you get nervous before you get up?" My answer is an honest no. I love what I do. It certainly fulfills me. I hate the travel. God, that's awful. The man who designed the original airplane seat was blind drunk. And he hated humans. But that's just the unpleasant part of it. But that's what I do, and I enjoy it. However, AA is another thing. For the next hour, I will have on my shoulders one of the most horrendous and frightening responsibilities that can be imagined. I'll be playing with your lives. I'm not here to entertain you. And I would hope that when you're up here and I'm out there, you remember that too. You're playing with my life. My task is to let you know what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I drank for 10 years, and it was rather unspectacular. If I told you every single thing about my drinking, it would put you to sleep. There's nothing bizarre about it. I was a teacher. I never once showed up drunk or naked in a classroom. Never roller skated down the center aisle of any cathedral. But in the space of 10 years, drinking nearly destroyed me. It was a threat to my life, my health, and above all, my priesthood. I was introduced to the martini on Thanksgiving Day of 1948, the year I was ordained and sent to California to teach. Four of us. You know, I remember as a seminarian, I had joined the Sulpician Fathers, and we train young men for the priesthood. And I remember asking my confessor, "What do you do with your day off?" And he laughed in my face. He said, "You don't get a day off. You're off when the students are off." The Sulpician, practically speaking, is a perpetual seminarian. You live by bells 24 hours a day. An extremely disciplined life, and I loved it. I truly did. So our first holiday was Thanksgiving. The boys went home. The seminary was out in the San Francisco area, down in the Santa Clara Valley. It's very beautiful orchard country. It's all homes now. And Mountain View, the tiny little town where the seminary was, that's Silicon Valley now. But anyway, it was very lovely. And Thanksgiving Day, four of us drove down to Santa Cruz to an old hotel, and we had the lounge to ourselves. And when the waiter came to ask us what we wanted, one of them said, "Have a Manhattan," and another one, "a dry Manhattan." And my closest friend in the priesthood, he became my closest friend, Father Larry Taylor, ordered a double martini. And straight, believe this or not, I'm 25 years old. I didn't know what a martini was. I said, "I'll have one too." Most people have to learn to drink martinis, and I learned very quickly. I love them. And the drinking progressed rather slowly. If you had told me in that first year that I had a drinking problem, I would have been stunned. I could have taken a lie detector test and come out clean, saying, "No, I'm not." But after a bit, I just became preoccupied with the drinking. There are wonderful restaurants out in the San Francisco area, and we loved to go out. You were free to go maybe once every 2 weeks, take a couple of hours, get another priest to watch your study hall while you were gone. And always the three double martinis and a very lovely dinner, and then back home. As time went by, after I was ordained 3 years, my mother died and I was called home, and I did some heavy drinking then. As you look back, your memory becomes a little bit keener, and you see some of the beginnings of what you would spot immediately in somebody else. So I went back to Mountain View. After 3 years there, I spent a year in Baltimore, my home, and then four more out west, and it was the drinking that ended my teaching there. You look at things that you've done, and it's obvious that something's wrong. Do you want to know what an alcoholic is? Look at the behavior that you're seeing and just answer this question. do normal drinkers do this? If your answer is no, it's not normal drinking. Now, you know, some jackass once said that we alcoholics are a cut above average intellectually. I always look at our patients like, you're so damn smart, what are you doing here? There's so many of us, there's got to be a brain rattling around in here somewhere. But do you know what horrendous problem, one of many, that plagued us intellectually superior people? What to do with empty bottles? A two-year-old would say, throw them out. We save them. We save them. Why? I have no idea. I think we're afraid to put them in the garbage because the garbage man will somehow know that we're drinking a bit. What does he care? He's got problems of his own. I had two suitcases into which I put empties. Together, they held maybe 40 to 50 empty fifth bottles. And when they got full, I had to do something with them. Well, we're down there in Santa Clara Valley, and we had our own dump, believe it or not, behind one of the old barns on the property. Now, I was smart. I was cut above average. I waited till the kids were in class before I went down to empty the suitcases. And, you know, the dress, the house dress then, for clergy, if you were in any institution, wore the long black cassock that came to the ground. Well, I would, I'd be dressed in the cassock. I'd wait till they were in the 11 a.m. class. I'd gather these two suitcases, and I'd light out for the dump. And you had to pass the swimming pool, tennis courts, and all the other sports facilities over there. I guess it kind of half occurred to me, but I never truly realized that all the students had to do was look out the classroom window, and they'd have seen Mrs. Martin's little boy dressed in a long black cassock carrying two suitcases heading into the hills. But I got down to the burial grounds, and I buried these dead soldiers one at a time, you see, consoled by the fact that every one of those dead soldiers had a priest with him when he died. And my friends, that is about the only vaguely humorous thing I can think of about my drinking. Something happens in here. You know that something's wrong. I knew I wasn't living the way I ought to have been, and it bothered me badly. My nerves began to get worse, and as I was I was a daily drinker. And of course, when you're hungover in the morning, you're not interested in food. You go to the table. And aren't you going to eat anything? No, I have a little touch of the flu or a cold or whatever. And you begin to live a lie. And lying is very important, my friends, because lying is a prostitution of the soul. The human mind is not a garbage pit. It is not meant for error or fallacy, or half-truth. It's built for truth. And we spend our lives seeking truth, trying to find the answers to who, where, when, what, and especially why. And I found myself lying to my superior whenever he would come out on his annual visitation. I would underplay the drinking. And I was scared to death whenever he called me in for my individual interview with him. Does he know? Does he know? No one said much to me, but toward the end of the fourth year of the second term there, my nerves just started to drive me crazy. And the house doctor, I was in the infirmary there for a few days, he put me in St. Mary's Hospital in San Francisco. And I was there for about 3 weeks, which meant that other priests had to pick up my courses and handle them. Father Taylor came down to pick me up when I was well enough to go home, and I felt wonderful. The doctor had me walking every day in Golden Gate Park. He was a very wise man, and his name fit him, Dr. Solomon. And he admitted to me that he knew nothing about what was... He never used the word alcoholism, never. He just said to me one day, "Well, Father, what do you think you'll do now that you won't be drinking anymore?" He simply implied that I would not be drinking anymore. And, you know, get a hobby. Well, I wonder how many unfulfilled hobbies are represented here in this room. How many attics and garages are filled with sets of golf clubs, and the bags have been home to generations of spiders. He said, "What would you do if somebody came to you with a problem and you didn't have the answer to it?" I said, "Well, I'd try to find it." He said, "Suppose you didn't find it?" I said, "Well, I'd send them to somebody I thought did have the answer." And he said, "Well, that's where I find myself." And then he asked me a simple question: "Would you be willing to see a psychiatrist?" I said, "Sure." I wasn't threatened by that at all. Father Taylor came to pick me up and bring me back to St. Joseph's in Mountain View, and we stopped for dinner, obviously in the city. Three double martinis and a lovely dinner. Ladies and gentlemen, within 10 days I was in worse shape, far worse shape than the shape I was in when I entered the hospital. They put me on an airplane and flew me back to Baltimore. And it was there I was assigned to St. Charles College, a prep seminary. Our headquarters are there anyway. And I spent the two most miserable years of my life. I tried to quit drinking and discovered that I couldn't. Terrified me. And the only thing that alleviated that fear was a little bit more of what caused it. And that vicious, vicious circle took over my life. Father McDonald, God bless his soul, he was so deeply concerned about me. He once said to me, "Drinking and teaching seminarians simply don't go together. You've got to do something about your drinking." And another time, with tears in his eyes, he said, "What is it you want? Name it. If it is available, it's yours, if it'll help you stop drinking." And then these very, very frightening words. The poor man was just baffled. "What are we going to do with you?" And every time he came near me after that, I was petrified. I'm 33, 34 years old. Will they retire me, put me someplace where I can't cause any scandal, where I will have no contact with the seminarians? What is my future? Scared to death. He came to see me, he asked me to go see him at the beginning of the Christmas holidays, the last year of my drinking. And he put me in the hospital over the holidays just to keep me from drinking. And when I walked into his office, he asked me point blank. He said, "Son, have you been drinking?" "No, Father." I knew I was lying. He knew I was lying. I knew that he knew it, and I could not say yes. And I believe that that is the ultimate degradation, to lie to someone that you know knows the truth. I wanted to disappear through the floor. Christmas afternoon, I'm looking out the window of the hospital room wondering, what in God's name are you doing in a hospital on Christmas Day? You ought to be home with the family. All my brothers and sisters lived there in the area. Well, I got out and I was terribly scared. He called again and said, I'd like to see you. And I thought, well, this is it. Scared to death. And he came over to St. Charles. He didn't have me to go to his office. He came to see me and told me that the pastor of the parish where I was helping out every Sunday asked him to remove me because some of the parishioners were very aware of my drinking and were shocked by it. God, I wanted to die. He said, John Peacock asked me to remove you. He just doesn't want you helping out there anymore. The shame, the terrible shame. He said, but we're sending you away this summer. This is not punitive. We simply want you to get well. And ladies and gentlemen, 98% of my problem flew right off of my shoulder. There are some in the program who do not believe in intervention. This man was not an alcoholic. He knew nothing about it. All he wanted to do was save me. Step 12 orders us to intervene. We tried to carry the message to the alcoholic. I'll talk about that later. I was so relieved. And on Sunday, June 15th, 1958, I entered a place called Guest House in Lake Orion, Michigan, near Pontiac. And I met the man who saved my life, Austin Ripley. Rip was the greatest man I have ever known in my life, and I have known some great ones. In order to understand me and understand everything I stand for, and some of the convictions that I have about sobriety that I will share with you, you have to understand Rip. He came into AA in 1940. AA was only 5 years old. The big book was only published a year. Rip was in Washington, and he read in the Saturday Evening Post the article by Anderson, publicizing Alcoholics Anonymous. He called AA and three people showed up and they put him in a hospital. He was dying on his feet of pneumonia. No antibiotics then. And he was drinking formaldehyde. Smelled like a biology lab. He just wasn't getting much from whiskey anymore. He was right at the end of his drinking. And he said to these people, give up on me and leave because I know that I'm going to die this way. I intend to get drunk when I leave the hospital just to get the taste of the place out of my mouth. And to show you how compassionate some AAs are not, one of the three people, two men and a woman, old Bugler Bill, he said, that son of a bitch will never make it to hell with him, and he walked out. Rip left the hospital and did get drunk, and the other man put him back in, Charlie Sullivan. And, you know, it's just like Ebbie Thatcher. Rip said every drunk on earth who is in sobriety owes Ebbie a debt of gratitude. He said Bill scored the touchdown, but old Ebbie handed him the ball. And then he couldn't stay sober himself till the last months of his life. And this guy, Charlie Sullivan, saved Rip's life, actually. And this was how he did it. Rip was in a semi-comatose state, but he said, every time I opened my eyes, that guy was seated on a chair beside my bed. And he asked him one day, don't you work? The man said, of course I do. He's a pharmacist. Why are you here? What do you want of me? Everybody wants something. And the man said, I want to see you get sober. Well, he had heard that from family and friends, and Rip was a professional writer for the Chicago Tribune. He had heard it from publishers and editors and everybody, but not from a stranger. I want to see you get sober. And that would not leave his mind. He got well enough, he left, and he went back to his home, a little town called Colfax, Wisconsin, right outside of Eau Claire. And he called AA. And they had one meeting, and it met once a week, Saturday night. And he had his wife drive him into Eau Claire, and the meeting was in a little room up over a bar, ironically. And he went up and knocked on the door, and there were four old fellows there. Maybe there was a high school diploma among them. I don't know. Austin Ripley was a genius. And they invited him in, and they sat down, and everybody started talking. And Rip kept looking at his watch. He said, well, when's this meeting start? The man said, what do you mean start? You've been in it for 20 minutes. He said, do you mean to tell me this is what this great movement is about that I've read about? That's helping drunks that no one else can? And the man said, what'd you think it was all about? We have found that when we openly and honestly share our drinking lives with each other, we also share a whole lot more. And he was so fascinated by that, he took a solid year of his life off to meet and know Bill and Dr. Bob. And I got my sobriety from them through him, second hand. You know what treatment was then? Old Doc Green explained what was wrong with us. Lectures about the disease. Rip did too. And it's from Doc Green's lectures that I took notes that make the chalk talk. That was the simplicity and the beauty of the things that saved my life. And when you tell me the chalk talk helped save my life, I know exactly what you're talking about because it saved mine. And then Rip explained AA over and over and over and over and over and over again. The history of it, how Bill and Dr. Bob got together, how through pure trial and error they discovered the steps. What they discovered was absolutely nothing new. All they did was validate a set of principles God gave human nature to live by in the beginning. My mother lived AA. Never heard of it. Within 5 minutes of being in the presence of Austin Ripley, I wanted to be just like him. God, whatever it was he had, I wanted. And for those reasons, I would have done anything he said without question. If he had said, Father, your first month here, sleep on the floor, I'd have done it. Blow your nose at 5:15 every day, I'd have done it. I'd have done anything he asked me to do. I've seen some of the most brilliant minds in the world follow him like puppies. He founded Guest House just for us alcoholic priests. He had to fight the church to help her, and he proved his point by succeeding. Rip taught the 12 steps. I believe with a passion that the depth and the seriousness with which we work or live the steps of AA depend directly on the depth and the seriousness with which we accept step one. Comparing the steps, as they're called, of AA to a ladder is an extremely poor comparison. When you climb a ladder, you leave steps as you go on to the next one. You never leave any of these steps. You never leave step one. Step one is a growing awareness of my condition. I'm an alcoholic. I don't handle alcohol. When I drink it, it handles me. And I don't drink it because I can't drink it. Our lives have become unmanageable. Well, maybe you do still run a company. Maybe you can still teach. Maybe you can still write. Maybe you can still read. That has nothing to do with the unmanageability of my mental capacities. Drinking, drugging, or thoughts of it, past or future, control 90% of our waking thought. Determine the people we associated with, those we stayed away from, restaurants we went to and those we stayed away from. My life was manageable. I was pulled like a bull with the ring in its nose by an inanimate object, alcohol. Alcohol comes to us in liquid form, right? You remember from First High Science what a liquid is? It's a substance that takes the shape of its container. It doesn't have shape, and it controlled my life. All of my functioning was towards obtaining and consuming this thing that I couldn't live without. And Rip taught me what an alcoholic is, somebody whose drinking causes trouble. You know, there are what we call self-evident truths. You can't prove them, you see them, or you don't. What causes problems is one, because it causes problems. And if your drinking makes trouble in your life, you got a drinking problem, and I call it alcoholism. No mystery to it. You know what a problem in my life was? Being racked up every time my superior came to me and talked to me about drinking. People don't talk to you about non-problems. I was transferred from San Francisco to Baltimore in April of a school year. Three priests had to pick up my courses, finish them, and give final exams. Never, never in my life have I been transferred 3,000 miles because of trouble with sliced tomatoes. It was alcohol. And Austin Ripley gave me a perfect definition of alcoholism. He said, look at the problems in your life. Has the bottle been in the picture before, during, or after? Doesn't make any difference. If you can connect drinking and trouble, you've got drinking trouble. I didn't need any more convincing than that. But so often we alcoholics have such a terrible time with the obvious. We can't see what a child is aware of. You know, the Canada geese fly through Havre de Grace on their way south and north. And about 10,000 of them winter over right there. And they're all over, Ashley. And they fly, as you know, most waterfowl, in a V formation. And one day in midwinter, it was right after lunch, I was standing with a couple of the fellows, patients, and two or three formations of these geese went over. And I said, you know, if I lived to be 8,000, that'll always impress me. And one of the fellows said, you know, Father, those V formations are beautiful, but have you noticed? It's never a perfect V. It's always longer on one side. I said, why is that? He said, there are more geese on that side. I'm expecting something out of the archives of the Smithsonian, you know. We begin, as I did, the process of getting well by admitting that there's something we have to get well from. We admit defeat. God, that's, for some people, that's unbearable. And to win a victory by acknowledging defeat goes against every military principle ever dreamed of. You don't win wars by surrendering for God's sake. You make the enemy surrender. Except in this war. Except this one. I am fighting a superior enemy. When I fight, I lose. The answer is don't fight, Bunky. Don't fight. You know what we perfectly intelligent men and women? We climb into a boxing ring every day of our lives with a champion, get beat up, and keep doing it. But we do it because we can't not do it. We are compelled to do it. And that's the baffling and frightening thing. I have a weakness. My body doesn't handle alcohol like the bodies of normal drinkers. I once heard a fellow get up at an AA meeting very early in my sobriety and say, you know what's wrong with me? My filter's busted. That made as much sense to me as anything I ever heard. When I take a drink, something happens in here that sets up a desire for another one. We drunks are funny. We do see the obvious. But the more and more we drug the brain, it becomes so fuzzy and so hazy, we can't see it. Do you know why I lied to Father McDonald? I was drawing the wagons around. I desperately, desperately wanted to believe that one day this agony would be over. But at that point, I could not envision living without drinking. We do anything to protect it, anything. And when you live by damaging daily your conscience, the pain becomes unbearable. You know, we call our disease soul sickness. The body bounces back from hundreds, even thousands of hangovers. God, the body heals almost overnight. Soul sickness. I believe that the greatest gift that God Almighty can give us is to allow us to look into a mirror and just feel an undeniable, overwhelming urge to vomit because we cannot stand what we're looking at. It is, I don't know how to describe it, filth personified. What am I? What is this thing that's looking back at me? Why can't I be decent? Why am I not decent? And the only thing that dulls that pain is a little bit more of what caused it. And so we go. I truly believe that God did not hate me, but I felt quite strongly it's wrong to posit a human emotion of a divine being, but I felt that in complete disgust, he had just quit with me. And I was alone. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you are addicted to any mood-altering chemical, you know what alone is. Not lonely. God, we're all lonely. I'm talking about alone. I felt that when I died, my soul would be put into orbit. Alone. Alone. And I felt that way till I walked into a room where there were other people who felt the same way. And I found out that you are like me. First friend of mine says, I stand up here and I say to all of you, I'm an alcoholic. You know everything about me. You tell me you're one, I know everything about you. The only thing different is a few minor details, which mean nothing. And so we go through the process of trying to climb out towards victory out of this admission of defeat. But I have found this. You've heard the old saying, truth sets you free. It does. There is something very liberating. It's like being let out of prison when you can admit, yes, I am an alcoholic. That is at the heart of the matter. That is what is wrong. Now, what can I do about it? I walk into a room where there are people who have said exactly the same thing, and yet they are not drinking. How did you do it? If the power to not drink is not in you, didn't you say you were powerless? Where did you get the power to not drink? They said, if it ain't in, it's out. It's outside, a power outside of ourselves, greater than we are. Now, if there's anybody in this room who is having trouble with a power greater than self, go up to your room tonight, go in the bathroom, look in the mirror, and if you can't come to the conclusion rather quickly that somewhere there's got to be something bigger than what you're looking at, you really have trouble. I came to believe that I could be restored to sanity. You know, I went to my first AA meeting the day after I walked in the guest house. The West Side Group, Pontiac, Michigan. And they had a wonderful custom there. I'd love to see it adopted universally. Whenever there was a brand new person in the room, they discussed step one. And I was at a point, I was not in denial, not at all. For 2 years I knew what was wrong, I just didn't know what to do. And so I listened with open ears and an open mind, and I could identify with every person in that room, even though the details were different. I could identify with the pain. God, I could identify with that. Step one, I can't handle it. Step two, God can. Step three, I think I'll get in touch. What do you mean to turn your will and your life over the care of God? Accepting the principles of AA. That is His care for us. When I embrace them, I've just placed myself under his care. But you know, we have wonderful slogans in AA, but you have to understand them. You know, I can imagine some poor slob, drunk for 30 years, comes in, they say, "Hey, let go and let God." And he's sitting there for the next hour thinking, "Let God what?" God will not make me sober. He will give me the strength to not drink, and then he will give me the way to use that strength, the 12 principles of AA. You ever heard people say, "My life's getting a little unmanageable. I think I better get out of the driver's seat and let God take over"? Try that, bunkie, and you'll wind up in a crash. God's not about to take over your life and make your decisions and do your laundry and prepare your meals. If you're in a car and you're having trouble driving, reach into the glove compartment. You know what God gives drivers? Maps! We've got the maps. There are 12 of them. And why am I getting excited? Let me calm down. What we usually do is open the glove compartment, shove the maps in, slam it shut, and step on the gas. And after a while we say, "Hey, my life's a little unmanageable." Well, of course it is. Then we have to clean up the act. Well, I took my fifth step to Austin Ripley, and it was the single most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. You know, we speak of humility. You know what humility is? It's stark truth. Don't deny the talents God gave you. God grant me the serenity to accept every gift he has given me, understanding where it has come from and why and how it is to be used. Humility is stark truth. And the truth of the matter is the real me. You see, every one of us is three. I am who you think I am. It's pretty accurate. I am who I think I am. A little bit more accurate. Then there's me. And through step four, I am asked to look into the mirror of self and chronicle everything that's there, the good and the bad. Step five says, I admit to God, self, and one, and other human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. Now, if you want somebody to know your good points, get up at an AA meeting and tell everybody how wonderful you are. But step five says, the exact nature of my wrongs. And ladies and gentlemen, for what it is worth, and it's worth plenty, there is one other human being who knows the real me. There's a lot of therapy in that realization. And I think that the surest path to humility is through humiliation. And I feel quite strongly that there's nothing more humiliating than making yourself, your whole self, known to one other human being.